Blog Talk Radio.
Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python Forums, www.moreliapythons.com, and also proud sponsor of ICAST, the International Collective Arboreal Symposium, www.arboreal-symposium.com. Hey, Owen, how's it going tonight?
I'm doing well.
Okay.
I'm excited. I want to get this whole ICAST thing. I want to get going down to that thing. It's like we're getting closer and closer, but it's like it's not happening fast enough. So
yeah, we're a little more than a week away. Yeah, so my vacation starts that week, so I'm double excited. So, but tonight we are joined by Buddy. He's going to give us a quick rundown of some updates of ICAST, and then after that, we have one of the vendors, Chris from Mystic Reptiles, is going to come on and talk
awesome.
About some of the cool projects that he's working with, and everything from retics to ring pythons, but pretty cool stuff. So let me click Buddy on
awesome.
And get this going. I hope this is actually Buddy. Hey, Buddy, is that you?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Welcome to the show.
You did that right. Good job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks again for having me. Thanks again for all your support, for allowing
Absolutely.
Me to come on and take up a little bit of your time this evening.
Of course.
But, yeah. So, you know, we've had our last big meeting Sunday night, and just want to go over a few things for the show. Some of the things are... that's going on. First thing is pre-registration, if you didn't know it already, ends tomorrow night at midnight. So
uh-oh.
If you want the meal, if you want the T-shirt, got to be done by midnight. We have a cutoff for the food and the T-shirt. The T-shirt folks actually emailed me today and said they wanted the T-shirt number today, and I told them they'd have to wait. So, so if you're, you know, waiting, if you like to wait to the last minute, just do it before midnight tomorrow night. That way you can get all the goodies that come with the show. The next big thing, I guess, that's going on is that Sunday we're going to have some demonstrations. You guys know we have Australian Addiction coming to the show, and, of course, Dr.
Uh-huh.
Ben Morell will be there. And one of the things that Ben is well-versed on, to say the least about it, is ultrasounds. He's actually going to do a demonstration. And he's going to do a little presentation. Then we're going to do try to do an ultrasound demonstration at the show.
Oh, that's awesome.
So people can see how they work, what it looks like.
And I've talked to Ben, and he will ultrasound anything that is it stills long enough to allow him to ultrasound it. So I know that Ben is like, you pretty much made his day now by letting him do that in a crowded room. So And I will definitely be jealous of him and his ultrasound when that whole thing goes down. I want one. So.
Right. That's, well, you know, if you've got a snake, you think that it is growing follicles. Ben has, you know, told me that if, you know, any of the vendors have an animal that they think is starting to grow follicles, he will gladly ultrasound them and get them in part of, have them as part of the demonstration.
Cool. I'll give him a white lip.
Nice.
I'll
bring Band-Aid.
Yeah, but if it's got follicles, then I'm like, holy crap, and I have to get it back home as quick as humanly possible. So
Just take it back to your room, let it run loose with the mail or something.
I'll have to bring the boy. All right.
Thanks.
Either way, get it to a boy as fast as possible.
And so the next thing we're working on, we're pretty sure this is going to happen. We're just firming everything up. But Dr. Rush, Dr. Marie Rush, the vet, the research vet that's going to be there, we're hoping she's going to be able to show people how to do injections, both subcutaneous and IM. So if you've never had to give a snake an injection before, a good firsthand experience to see how it's done properly. Have her go over how to, a lot of the vet places that deal with exotics always aren't close to us. And a lot of times the vet will send you a swab to do a culture if you're, you know, swabbing for a respiratory infection. And we want her to go over how you would properly culture for that. That way you're putting the swab where it needs to be. That way you're actually getting what's growing in the trachea and esophagus and all that stuff. So, and also hopefully go over some sexing. I get a lot of requests from people that, you know, I've been doing snakes for a while, and at least with chondros are a little concerned about doing the sexing of chondros. And so I think I might bring some of my yearling snakes, and if she's willing to do it, we'll go through that, and she can show people how to do it properly and delicately enough. So
that's excellent, because I knew that some people, when it first comes to it, are a little touchy, a little nervous,
right,
a little anxious when it comes to popping babies. Some
right.
of them could even be termed as like being little sissies when it comes to popping babies, Eric. And they don't really, you know, they can have their friends do it for them. So.
Right.
Right.
It's good to have that come out, because but you don't ever want to hurt the baby, so it is good to have somebody show the different versions of sexing that, you know,
right,
to get through it, and this way you don't snap any spines or do anything crazy.
Exactly.
Plus,
exactly. And with working with chondros, you guys know that, you know, it's taboo to, you know, sex a baby before they're at least a year of age. So
I know that now.
Yeah, and now we... And we don't normally pop them. We actually normally probe them. So
yeah.
All right. So that was wrong with mine. All right.
Owen's an amateur when it comes to that side of Morelia.
Right.
Oh,
he doesn't keep that.
Oh,
he's not really sure about how we do that.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now we're starting.
But that will all change in August, from what I guess.
I'll be a master.
Well, that's pretty cool, because I know one of the things that, like, when I first, you know, Owen, he's just busting my stones about it, but, I mean,
yeah,
I've seen it done, but I don't know, when, you know, you're just afraid that you're going to hurt the snake,
right,
and, you know, it's that's pretty cool. Good thing.
Yeah. So, hopefully, you know, we're about 95% certain she's going to be down with doing all this stuff, so we just got to make sure we have needles and all that fun stuff for her to do, so. So the other thing is, talk about the hotel discount. Some folks have not been able to get the discounted rate at the hotel. We blocked out more rooms. If you have made a reservation and for some reason they have said you can't get the discount, double check that they're using the code Arboreal Symposium, not ICAS. And if you're still having difficulty, you can, you know, call me, email me, or text me if you have any of that information. My email address is right on my website at gtpkeeper.com. I'm also on Facebook. So whatever way you prefer, if you cannot get the discount, contact me and I will get it taken care of for you. Everyone showing up should get the discount for the room, and we want to make sure that that's taken care of.
Okay.
Thing is, we have one of our condor friends coming down from Philly, and he is all about GoPro cameras, which are these mobile high-definition cameras that you can put anywhere. So the show's going to be videotaped from start to finish.
Cool.
And he's going to help us with, he's going to do the editing, and we're not sure how it's going to, how we're going to use it in the future. We're thinking maybe like a collage of the show. But so just be wary that, you know,
everything I do will be
videotaped.
Is this what you're telling me? This is, I knew this
yeah.
was a service now for my ass. Okay.
Right. vendors, if you're listening, we can go over this. We'll try to get this out to the vendors. If you're bringing your signs, which we hope you're bringing, try not, we were at the hotel's asked us not to use tape on the walls. So if you know, if you use tape to hang your sign, we don't want you to do that. If you need help thinking of another option, contact us. We have some ideas.
Okay.
Cool.
Let's see. My other thing on the list here is also don't forget we'll be doing a Best in Show award. And how this is going to work is we're actually going to do a 50-50 raffle while we're there, and so you buy these tickets, however much we raise for the 50-50, half goes to the Best in Show award. Half is going to go to whoever's number gets drawn at the end of the show. So you could walk away with a little bit of cash, maybe. Or Best in Show with a little bit of cash in your pocket.
Cool.
So you're out there and you know, you're a vendor. You know, even if you're thinking that, you know, a lot of people are probably going to bring smaller animals and animals to sell. But, you know, if you can bring maybe an animal that you really think is the cornerstone of your collection, maybe stands out, definitely bring it. And, right now, the plan is to have our award recipients decide who receives the Best in Show award.
Oh.
Oh, cool.
So.
That is cool. So, suck up to those people?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Exactly.
All right. All right. I got you.
Mark gave us a really good glimpse of part of the awards these folks will be receiving, and they're very cool. Very, very cool. You'll think they're the best thing ever. You'll want one, but you have to earn one. We don't just give them away. You actually need to earn
it. I already do. I mean, like, you haven't even told me what it is. I already want it.
There you go.
Damn.
And also, a couple people have asked with the meal, will they be getting anything to drink? Yes, you will be getting a soft drink and a bottle of water with your meal on Saturday.
Okay.
Cool.
All right, and that is pretty much everything that I wanted to go over, unless you guys have some more questions for me. I can end my part here, and we can listen to Chris.
Cool. I'm pretty good.
No, yeah, I think you hit on everything. Just hope it gets here quick.
Yeah.
It's here. It's here.
Yeah, so, okay. Very cool.
All right, guys.
Awesome.
All right, thanks, buddy.
Thank you for letting me come on. I appreciate it. And once again, thanks so much for all the support you've given us.
Absolutely.
Good thing. We'll see you soon. All right?
Yes, we will. All right. Have a great night. I'm going to go listen to Chris now.
All right.
Bye, bye, buddy.
Bye.
Cool stuff. Cool stuff. Very, very exciting stuff. I'm looking forward to this award ceremony thing. Should be cool.
Oh, yeah.
Something you got to earn.
I know. But now that there's like a Best in Show, like I may like polish my snakes before we go. Don't ask me how I'll do it. I'll figure out a way, goddammit.
Oh, man, Owen. I was going to say, you can't polish a turd, dude.
Oh.
I'm just kidding.
Oh, that hurt. Oh, the pain.
The first cut's the deepest.
We are sharing a hotel room. Do you really want to do this? We'll do this. I can do this.
Well, you know, you're the comic relief on the show. Sometimes you got to get your stones handed a little
I'm just saying someone's probably going to wake up in
the
shower now.
Last year I said that I have high-end animals with low-end equipment.
Low-end caging.
And you have high-end caging. And, I'm not going to fill in the rest. And this year was you can't polish a turd. I will not say another thing until next year, 2014.
Thank God. I don't know if I could take it if you and I had to go back and forth all the damn time.
Yeah,
right.
So, let's get rolling here with Chris from Mystic Reptiles, because we got a lot to go over with him, and
yes,
I'm looking forward to talking with him. So let's get him on here. Hey, Chris, welcome to Moray Python Radio. Glad to have you.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. I guess I'm following the polishing of a turret, huh?
Yeah.
Don't worry. That's solely directed at me because, you know, that happens.
Yeah. I feel welcome, though. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not mean to the guests, just each other. So.
Yeah, that's all.
Gotcha.
Awesome. Well, Chris, why don't you start us off with how did you start getting into reptiles in the get-go?
Wow. Well, I mean, I think, you know, most of us have pretty much the same story. It kind of follows the same thing as far as getting into it at a young age, having a real attraction to reptiles, you know. I can't say that I was out herping, you know, at 10, 12 years old with my dad. But what I did was, you know, in South Florida, you know, I would spend a lot of time in the library, you know, and kind of, you know, nerd in that way, and just reading books and just kind of getting it, just kind of attracted to these snake keeping books, because that's what we had back then in the early 80s. You know, there was like no computer or internet that you could, you know, Google things and just immediately it pops up. So anyways, I would read through these books and you would see pictures and it would just create this, you know, imagination of what it would be like to keep these animals, you know, in captivity. So at the end of the books, they would have these companies listed, exporters, importers, and I would write to them and, you know, they would send you eventually like a price list, an inventory list every month. I think it was California Zoo Supply, Glades Herpetofauna from Crutchfield, and things like that. And it was just a blast. I mean, it was like, I don't know, it sounds pretty dorky, but to me it was seeing all these crazy exotic animals with a price next to them, like you could actually buy this. So,
oh, that's cool.
I mean, it just really created a interest and a fascination, and just being able to keep these exotic animals in your room or your house that are indigenous to another part of the world. It's just amazing to me, the whole setup of a cage, and it just kind of got me hooked. So, you know, I would go into pet stores and I would just immediately be drawn to the reptile department, you know, like pretty much all of us were. And, you know, at that time they had a lot of cool stuff that you, well, I don't even know if they have pet stores and malls anymore, but that's kind of where it started, you know, for me. And so then I spent some time in the military and I got out. I was out of reptiles completely at that point, you know. I got out and going, you know, I was at University of Florida and a friend of mine said, let's go down to this reptile show in Orlando. And so little did I know that would, that trip would basically change my life because, I mean, that was like 98. So it was the NRBC that was in Orlando at that time. And I walked up to this table and it was Eugene Bissett. And I just said, oh, hey, you're an archer. You're right near Gainesville. So you ever looking for any help? You know, just kind of half kidding. And he's like, I'm always looking for help. Good help. So I stopped by there the next day and it was like a mecca. You know, it was just, you know, that, you know, what you
think. The angel chorus. Yeah.
The angels were hissing. And just like a mass, it was my first introduction to, first of all, a reptile expo. And then after that, a mass breeding operation, commercial operation. So I did my volunteer time for him and ended up, you know, just being on the staff for the next few years. And it's kind of how it went. And after that, I caught the bug, and it was no turning back from there.
Wow. So what brought about forming Mystic Reptiles?
Well, you know, my wife and I were looking for a house, and we kind of settled on this this property that was outside of Gainesville. It had a separate building on the property, and I always envisioned it as, you know, naturally a reptile room.
Of course.
Of course, you know, I mean.
Yeah, yeah, that's what that's for.
So what it came down to is, you know, my collection was not large, but I mean, I think I had maybe 20 to 30 animals, but it was taking more time than I wanted it to maintain them. So I just got to the point where it was like, okay, I need to either cut back and just have like 5 animals and enjoy them as a hobby, or really put in an effort to make this go as a business, or at least make something profitable to the point where I can, you know, afford to pay for my own food and that kind of thing. You know? So I spent the whole night just considering it and writing it, putting it down on paper, logistics of it and finance and et cetera. And I just felt like if I didn't do it now, that I would regret it and I'd never, you know, have an opportunity to do it. So I didn't want to have any regrets. So I just kind of jumped into it with both feet and here we are.
Nice. That's awesome. So you have a pretty extensive collection over there. Can you mind giving us an overview of some of the species that you work with?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess my main focus is the retics. I also do a lot of carpet stuff. I have some of the niche species, Angolans, rings, white lips. I did have a group of Moluccans until recently. I have Brazilian rainbow boas. Let's see, what else? I think that's basically, you know, that's basically it. I tried to cut down on the amount of species and just, you know, try to, at some point you have to focus, you know. It can get really crazy if you're trying to breed, 50 different things, so.
Right.
But that's cool. Essentially what I'm working with.
Cool, cool. So you have a bunch of different morphs of retic right now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
Cool. They've always been kind of very gorgeous looking, but I'm terrified of them. You know, the 20-foot tiger at my old work kept me on edge, so no more. So
yeah, it can be intimidating.
Yeah, a little bit, especially for someone Eric's size. I mean, he's lunch, but we won't go there.
You jackass.
Well.
He probably towers over me though, so.
We all don't know until ICAST. Then we'll all figure it out. So now it says on you say on your site that your operation is rooted in genes, principles, and techniques. What do you mean by that?
That's a good question. Well, I mean, Gene's a pioneer, in our hobby industry. I owe pretty much everything that I have to him because he gave me an opportunity. And it's not everybody will allow you into their operation. So what I mean by that basically is that, you know, with Gene, it's go big or go home, you know. He's not going to buy 3 bags of mulch. He's going to buy 2 pallets of mulch. He's not going to build a 6-foot cage for retail. He's going to build an 8-foot by 3-foot cage, you know, and he's going to do it himself. And he's very innovative. He's always looking for a better way to utilize his space, to be more efficient as far as his staff, as far as how fast fast and efficient you can clean, you can get through, you know, this rack or what have you. There's a lot of hard work that goes into it too. That's one of the biggest things that it was an eye opener to me is the amount of work that goes into running an operation like that. I mean, it's, it's never ending. I mean, it's 7 days a week, you know, all year. Vacations are probably limited to an extended reptile show weekend, you know.
yes. yes, they are.
But, yeah, I know how that goes. But, you know, and so when I say, and also another thing I like to add is just, you know, I was looking at some YouTube videos Jay on prehistoric pets and working with his retics and everything, and it's amazing to me how he can like freely handle these guys, these females, and the way they work with them there, it blows my mind. I mean, they'll just take this, you know, 18-foot giant out of her cage on the floor and clean the cage while she's right there and do what they need to do. They're like puppy dogs.
Right.
And it's just such a different philosophy that we kind of, that I grew up working with the animals at his place. And I think mainly that's due to the staff that he's probably got in place. And I'm not, by no means am I saying all retics are just giant, you know, insane killers, but.
right.
You know, when you're working with them on your own, there has to be some safety consideration. And that's what I think Gene did to, as far as working that cage. If you're in the building by yourself working 8 foots on berms, which is what he had at the time, I mean, you have a divider, you move the animal to one side, you can clean that side of the cage, and then you move them, and it's all done in a safe way where you don't really have that interaction, that contact. You're just manipulating the animal.
Right.
So it's just really a quite different philosophy in the way, you know, maybe the West Coast does it compared to the way we do it. And really, I mean, I'm nocturnal, and I'm out there a lot of times at night on my own working with the snakes, and I can't afford to, you know, have something like that go wrong. And so I choose to, you know, go on the safer route as far as handling them and what and things like that. So, I could spend a lot of time, you know, as far as his philosophy goes and everything, but I think that kind of nails it, you know.
Cool. So, now, when you talk about snake farming on your site, what does that mean? And can you give us some insights that you learned from Bob over at Ancient Reproductions?
Yeah, sure. Well, snake farming, I mean, it's not something that you would think in the classical term of farming.
You're not, like, killing crops that grow snake, yeah. So.
Right. You're using the land for either domestic animal production or for crop, but it is using the land to produce animals, and the animals happen to be exotic. So in most cases, they're indoors in a facility, but you are farming them. You're using, you know, you're using animals for food. You're producing animals. You're breeding animals. You're holding back animals. It's a constant, you know, turnover. And to me, it's kind of like farming, and especially down here in Florida, because there's, I mean, I can only see, you know, Bob, Eugene, myself, we have some acreage, we have land, so we're kind of on our own, and we use the land, you know, to our advantage as far as being able to use it for our operation. And it's kind of different than if you're, like, in Boston and you have, like, a basement, you know, with chondras or emerald tree, but I can see where that may not fall into the snake farming, you know.
Right.
But down here is kind of like a swamp, and it's you know, we have, there's a lot of critters out. I leave the doors open at night, you know, not completely open, but to get fresh air in, and there's a lot of bugs. It's really like almost like an outdoor farming that's just done indoors. So I don't know, it's kind of a that's the best way I could describe it.
Cool.
So, you know, as far as with, you know, Bob, we kind of go back a little ways, and he, you know, he worked for Eugene too back in the 80s, I think it was. And he's just a phenomenal breeder of, you know, anything. I mean, you give him any animal, any crop, and he's a farmer. He you know, looks at it in a practical approach, and he also looks at it, you know, scientifically. So he's just, his intelligence is off the charts, I think, when it comes to that. So he helped me get my fundamentals down, just as far as basic stuff, like, you know, hey, you want to have your males low and your females high, you know, switch these up, and your temps are off, and, you know, the incubator, things that I never thought of before, like, you know, he would say to me, he's like, dude, you can't afford to have an incubator failure. I mean, how many, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or whatever do you have in this incubator? What happens if there's a failure? Do you have a backup? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, why are you having an incubator in a room that's 84, 85 degrees? You know, you should have this closed off in its own system, and, you know, you should probably invest in a, you know, high quality incubator. And, I haven't really took his advice on that yet, but it makes sense, you know.
Yeah.
It
makes
sense.
Take time.
Well, yeah, I mean,
yeah.
So it can't be done overnight, but, you know,
right.
So it just got me thinking in those terms, you know, using in weather systems to your advantage as far as breeding and the whole lunar calendar, and just kind of thinking outside the box, and I think he's good at that, and I think it's been a real positive, you know, influence and helped me tremendously.
That's awesome.
Huh. That was interesting that you said about keeping your males lower. Are you talking about just if you have an rack system, you're keeping them lower because typically it would be cooler down on that end?
Right.
Is that what you're driving at?
Exactly.
Huh.
Hmm.
Okay. I never thought about
that
before.
Yeah, I've seen it both ways, you know.
Right.
But ideally, I guess he's looking at it in an ideal setup.
Sure, yeah. I think that, like, when people set up their rooms or their facilities or whatever, I mean, you know, there's a lot that has to be taken into account. You know what I mean? I know just with carpet pythons, you have, you know, just even the flow of how it goes from top to bottom. You should have, you know, IJs and jungles and, you know, Darwin's at the top, and then, you know, coastal's next, and then your colder species like your Brettles and your Diamonds should be down lower, that type of thing. And, but yeah, I mean, just all that stuff comes into play. Speaking of reptile business, let's talk a bit about the reptile business. You know, I always like to ask people this question and talk to people and get their insight, because I think a lot of us would like to do this as our full-time job. You know, we're afraid to take the plunge, or, you know, not sure that we would be able to, you know, pay the bills or keep the, or we would lose the passion or whatever the case would be. But do you plan to do this full time at some point? And if so, what would your advice be to someone that wants to make their hobby their full time job?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hope to. It's always been my goal to, since I started in 2006, to be my own boss, to own my own business, and what better way to do it than work with, you know, reptiles. And I just can't think of a better way to make a living. So hoping by this time next year I'll be full time if things fall into place. You know, if you know, the season goes the way I hope, and you know, my wife is in a PhD program, my wife Nicole, for archaeology, so she should be hopefully getting that taken care of this semester or the next, so that'll help things a lot too. I mean, it depends on your financial situation and your family situation. There's a lot of things that come into play. You know, you said taking the plunge in full time is a scary deal, And you know, to go back to Gene, and I asked him one time, I was like, when did you know that it was time for you to go at it full time? Because he was working at like the post office for a long time, and he said, when I had critical mass, when I had enough animals to the point where me going to work was, I was losing money by going to my job.
Right.
So, you know, at that point, he's like, I had to put my notice in, and that's kind of, that's never left, you know, my thought. And it's a good way to put it. You know, I think that you absolutely need to have enough animals to support yourself, because, yeah, you can have 10 beautiful, you know, gorgeous, top-of-the-line, whatever species it is, but what if this happens? What if that happens? You have to have backups to the backups. So the way I look at it is, as far as retics go, I mean, I shoot for 20 females. If I could get 20 mature females, I'm looking at maybe half conservatively that'll go. That'll put me in a position where I can, if you're looking at worst case scenario, I'll still make out. So that's always been kind of my goal for that. So, but as far as, you know, going at it as a business for other people, it's, you know, like I said, you have to have the animals, you have to have a smart game plan, I think. You have to invest wisely. It's a weird market. It can turn, you know, I invested in, you know, in Angolan pythons when I started. They were 5,000 a pair. You know, now they're, you know, around 1,000 to 1,200 a pair. So things go up and down. And,
right.
You know, there's also very few that actually do it full time. Like,
right,
make their living solely on their income from reptiles. So it's kind of a rare thing, but that's always been my goal. So
cool.
Okay. Now, when I was looking at your site and some of your posts and everything that you had on Facebook and such, the one thing that fascinates me but scares me at the same time is applying for CITES permits. And, you know, I guess that kind of opens up the door to, now you're worldwide rather than just trying to sell in the United States. You know, have you applied yet? And if so, what's the process like?
Yeah, I think that's probably the next step for the mid-level breeders, because the top guys are obviously doing that. You know, but I think Bob Clark probably spends more time overseas than he does in the States. And I could be wrong, but I know he does a lot of shows over there, and he's grown his business globally. So it's important. I mean, it's a global market now, and I think it's going to be more important as, you know, more regulations come down on a lot of these animals that we keep.
Right.
So, you need to have an outlet, and, hey, if you can't sell them in the States, you could possibly still work with them and just be able to export them. So to answer your question, I've looked into CITES. I have not gotten a permit for it, though. What I've been doing is just going through another broker to add on to their, you know, their order for overseas. And that seems to be the easiest way to go about it at this point.
Okay. Well, what is it like shipping something? Are you shipping out overseas, or are you bring in overseas?
No, I don't. I'm a breeder. I'm strictly a breeder. I don't broker anything. What I produce is what I sell, 99% of it. So I have a closed colony, and I don't do anything like that. I mean, I'll just, if I wholesale or if I sell to someone else, I'll just add on to their order, and it'll go from there.
Okay. All right. Very cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
You brought up a good point, and you know, about the whole legislation and all that kind of stuff. And for someone who's looking to have their ultimate goal be going full time in the reptiles, where do you see the future of the reptile business? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I'd like to be positive. the way government, you know, is trending, it's hard to be optimistic. It just seems like they're hell-bent on adding everything, in, you know, to the Lacey Act and that they can, and just the whole political, you know, atmosphere and the lobbyists that are out there against the reptile industry. It's tough, man. It's like, it's really tough sledding, and it's going to take everything we have to try to maintain our right to keep the animals. And I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic, but at the same time, I'm realistic, and I realize that, you know, there's a probability that a lot of these, you know, bigger snakes, whatever, what have you, are going to be added to that eventually. So, you know, you just have to kind of go with that. But I right now, I mean, I love the market. I love the hobby. I think there's so much interest from – it used to just be like kind of the, you know, the anybody that didn't conform, you know, were into reptiles. And you still see that at shows. I mean, of course.
Right.
You know, but now it just, you know, you have everybody that's into reptiles from what, you know, whether it's bearded dragons or geckos, or there's something for everybody. And I think the you know, the ball python market, I can't really speak on because I don't own any balls. But yeah, I don't have one.
Neither do I.
Right.
Just doesn't do anything for me.
Nope.
But, no, I think, you know, the retic market is incredible. I think the niche animal market is definitely on the rise. People are looking for alternatives, and the carpet community is amazing. And strong. I mean, there's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of information, knowledge out there with the internet. You know, buyers today, even beginners, they're so far, they're sophisticated, you know. They're not just looking for the basic husbandry. They're looking for, you know, certain pattern and mutations and the things that, you know, beginners are looking for. It's crazy now, but
right.
It's amazing.
That's pretty cool.
But, yeah, I love it. I think it's really an incredible you know, market, and hopefully we'll be able to keep doing it for a long time, you know.
Right.
Awesome.
Now, I know this question for myself, but, like, if you're going to do it full-time, I hear a lot of people say, you know, from time to time that, you know, it kind of becomes a job, it becomes, you know, you lose your excitement for it. You know, how do you keep things exciting and not lose your passion for the animals, especially if you're considering going full time? To me, it's just I just can't see myself not being passionate about them. But, you know, that's just me. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a really good point. there's absolutely times that I'm not feeling it, and I just won't go in the room. You know, there's things that happen in life, you know. And there's times when you just maybe are not in the right frame of mind to work the snakes. So, you know, you may have to step back and then not go in there that day. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You know, I'm not really – I don't abide by the conventional husbandry. You know, I don't – I do things more on a feel basis. And,
okay.
You know, so it's – as far as maintaining the passion for them, though, man, I mean, just work a regular job and the passion isn't there, you know. Because what beats, you know, working with snakes? I mean, it's hard work,
yeah,
no doubt, but it beats a lot of stuff out there. So, no,
oh, yeah.
I love the animals. you know, I mean, I love working the animals. It's just, you know, once you get in there and you start sweating, you're just, you know, it's hard not to be excited about it. And, I mean, yeah, cleaning crap off the walls of the cage is not the most glamorous thing in the world. But,
right.
You know, it's a means to an end. And, you know, I just remember, try to keep in my mind, you know, seriously, that you know, I'm the one that's really in charge of these animals. They're in my care. They can't tell me what's wrong with them. you know. So it's up to me to maintain them in the most humane, decent way I can, and that involves, you know, constant interaction. It involves being engaged every day on a regular basis, you know. And I think that's important. So, you know, I just, you know, I put music on and I just go out there and just work the snakes, man. It's just, and it's a release. You know, some people go mountain biking or whatever. I go in the snake room and work snakes. It's a great release. So, it's killer. You know, it's killer. You guys know, you walk into a room and you have an incredible collection, and it's like, geez, it's humbling, and you know, you just want to get in there and it's great. You just don't lose it. And when that time comes, when it becomes not fun and you're not excited about it anymore, then, you know, that's probably the time to reevaluate things.
Right.
Right.
Just on a side note, what's the music of choice when you're cleaning the snake room?
Oh, man. It's it could go from Black Sabbath to jazz to anything. I mean, classic rock, alternative, you know.
Ah, cool. Very cool.
Nice.
That's just how I do it. Mix it up.
Yeah, if I'm feeling your text, it's usually Pantera. if I'm working with babies, it might be, you know, Pete Yorn or Pink Floyd or something a little more mellow, you know.
Gotcha. Gotta get the blood pumping for the retix, I hear you.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that I saw on your site that I was quite impressed with, actually, was your actual facility, and we talked about it a little bit earlier. This is kind of the step where I'm at, where you're kind of like, okay, well, I've done it in my house. Now it's time that, you know, my collection is big enough where I sort of have to think about taking it outside and, you know, having its own spot where it's at. Talk a little bit about your facility and what you got on your site and how you have it set up and, you know, what are some of the things that you would recommend to someone that's setting up a new snake building?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first thing I recommend is security. I think that's primary. I mean, if you don't have security to keep people out and keep the animals in, then you're in trouble eventually down the road. And it doesn't matter if you're working with big snakes that are dangerous or whether you're working with ball pythons. It's just, it's got to be necessary. It's got to be, you know, you have to have things safe too. I mean, I don't use a lot of flex spot in my building at all. I try not to use any more than I need to, just based on the bad track record with, you know, these things going on, fires and whatnot. So, you know, but there's, when the fires happen with, you know, Chad's place and everything, it just, I think a lot of people started to reevaluate and look at the security of their building and inspect things and get fire alarms put in place. And those things are all really important, but they could be overlooked when you're looking at starting a new facility.
Right.
I know I did. It's not something that was forefront of my mind. It was just, okay, how do I get this from point A to point B? but, you know, my building is, it's 1,200 square feet. It's broken down into four rooms. One is an upstairs room. And the two outer rooms were an open carport. So what we did was close them in. So we have three functional rooms and took out the rusty old garage door and put the double door in. And it's, you know, it's really well insulated. It's very functional. It's got its issues, you know. But because it's an old building, it's a block building, but it's a little crowded and cramped, but I really like the way it's come about, you know. You know, for right now, it's it allows me to do what I need to do, and it's I didn't have to start from the ground up and put a whole new building in place or try to make use of, you know, a small space. So there's a lot of flexibility there. And what I have is basically the front room is the Neodesia cages. So that houses all the carpets, Angolans, rings, stuff like that. It's a little bit cooler room. And then the middle room is the Ophiological Service cages, the cages that Gene built, big melamine, 8 foots, 4 foots, that's for the retics. I have a sink in the main room that's kind of centrally located, and then I have another room that's mainly for racks, for babies, stuff like that. So,
cool.
Yeah. Now, you said real quick earlier that you try to use FlexWatt as least as possible. What are you using? Are you using something different, or what's your heat of choice?
Well, I think babies do better with heat, so I'll use some heat rope for the racks for them. It doesn't put out a ton of heat, but the hot spot's generally around 90, you know, so I think it serves a purpose, and it's much safer. It's easier to wire, and you can loop it, you know, you can do a lot with it, so I kind of like using that. For the adult females of any species, I use basking lights in their cages, and mind you, most of my cages, I don't have a lot of door systems, so everything I have is basically built in with basking lights, so that's kind of what I'm limited to using. And I've come to like it. You know, it's got its pluses and minuses, of course, but I think it allows some light during the day, and it also provides heat. So I think it's a more natural system. You're not getting the belly heat, but, you know, it's I think it works pretty well that way. For males, I don't really use much heat at all. Maybe that's me being unconventional, but I just kind of rely on the ambient heat. I don't want my males to get too hot. And in Florida, it's just, you know, in the summer, it's hot enough as it is. You really, it's just something that I kind of went away from.
Okay.
And they seem to do really well with it. And another thing I can add to that is that once a male is put into a cage with a female, it tends to stimulate him a little bit if he's got that supplemental heat. So it's kind of an extra stimulation for him. Not that he's not healthy or not, you know, eating right or anything like that, but it's just that extra stimulant that kind of, you know, I think helps in breeding a little bit. But,
cool.
Yeah, so to answer your I use a lot of ambient. I just make sure my ambient temps are straight. And the females that eat bigger meals, yeah, they definitely need some heat to digest. You know, males, they're not eating big meals, so I really am not worried about them as far as that goes.
So what do you shoot for, like a flat line 82 or something like that? 82 degrees, 80 degrees, somewhere in there?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
79 to 83.
Okay. Cool.
Awesome.
Well.
So. Go on.
Go ahead, Eric. No.
Well,
I was going to say
my thing is now, because we very rarely get somebody who has wet lips on the show other than myself, who just rants about mine every once in a while. So it's very cool to have someone who can somewhat relate. And you successfully bred your gold phase wet lips this past year, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I had I've had two clutches for my female, 2010 and 2012.
Sweet. All right. So, can you give us a rundown of how you keep the gold phase? How you keep your wet lips?
Well, it's been a progression, you know. I used to keep them in tubs, and then for a long time, and then I had them in like 2 foot cages, but I've found that they do better in bigger caging, and I just happen to have these, you know, 8 foot Neodesia cages. I had an extra one, so I split it up, divided it, put the male on one side, the female on the other, and they have climbing branches, they have a hide box, so, and they have a good size soaking tub. So I try to give them the options, you know, that work for them, whatever they want to do. They'll use the branches to climb. They'll sometimes they'll be in the hide. I have them on cypress mulch, and I block off the screens so that I can keep the humidity kind of high. So you know, you sacrifice airflow, but you know, I think it's a little bit, you know, I'll sacrifice that, you know, as long as the cage is clean. So it's pretty simple setup, you know. But I'm not saying that you can't keep them in a drawer system or a smaller cage environment. I'm just, that's just kind of what works for me.
I mean, I have our youngest boy, Gold. He's in a rack system right now, but he even has a high humidity hide box, which is filled with wet moss and stuff, and he spends most of his time in there. But it's just the way that they go. They seem to really like high humidity. So when it comes to breeding, did you have to do anything really special with them? How did you kind of get them to interact with each other and kind of cue in the breeding?
Yeah, definitely. Let me just say one thing on what you mentioned with the moss box. I used to use moss boxes with the adults, but it just got to the point where it was so time-consuming to try to keep the moss, you know, the right consistency, because it starts to get slimy, and it gets too wet,
yeah,
and it's too dry. It's just, it became such a headache. But I will use that with the small, with babies, with the yearlings. I definitely use some type of moss box because they use it, and it's a little easier to you know, work with. But as far as breeding goes, you know, I had my female was 10 years old before she bred. So,
okay.
Yeah, she's an older girl. She was like a 2000, I think. So. I think the maturity played a big part in it. I think that, you know, I've tried multiple males in the past, and they just basically try to kill each other, and they're not interested in the girl. So what I found is that if I just provide them with a big enough space, you know, put one hide on one side, another hide on the other, initially the male's usually in one hide, the female's in the other. A couple of days later, if they're compatible, you'll see them together, or you won't.
Yeah.
And luckily for me, they, you know, decided they liked each other. So they were everything worked out after that. But, you know, I did cycle them a little bit. I dropped the temperature. I think that helps a lot with white lips. I'll let it get down into the upper 60s for sure. And, you know, obviously it's important to bring the temperature up during the day so they can get that heat back up because they will get, respiratory infections. I think they're prone to it. But I think cooling them is important. I think, you know, I'd like to say misting is, but every time I try to mist them, they just try to kill me. So, you have to do that, take some caution with that. Not that I'm about getting bit, but they're going to damage themselves by striking the glass or something like that. But, yeah, I think that if you look at, you know, where they're from, the rainforest habitat and, you know, New Guinea, Papua New Guinea area, and I think rainfall is important, and I think cooler temps are. But I think the mistake that a lot of people make is I think they overfeed their females, and I think they don't give them enough time. I think they have to be a little bit older. That's not to say they can't breed at 4 years, but I just think you'll get a healthier, more productive clutch if you allow her to go at her own pace, you know.
Cool. So what we're experimenting with our white lips is the possibility of a burrow. A lot of things we've been talking about with a few people who actually have had success is that they had makeshift burrows and dens and things like that for the white lips, and that's where they spent a lot of their time, where they bred and where the female laid her eggs. Do you see any truth to possibly providing a burrow or someplace under a mulch that they could hide in?
Yeah, that's a cool idea. I like that. You know, I think the hide box probably works as that function. Mm-hmm. I've utilized the nest box form. You know, mm-hmm. I put a nest box in there with moss, and she's used it. She's laid in it. Okay. I think her first clutch definitely used the nest box, and then I think the second year she just laid in the hide. So maybe it has something to do with the confidence of the female, you know. But I think I think the burrow is a great idea.
Yeah, I said something we heard about from someone overseas who apparently took giant clay pots and cut the tops off of them and then buried them halfway and let them be a burrow for the animal. And apparently it worked out well for him. So something to give it a shot. Why not?
Absolutely.
So that's cool. I'm glad you got your success with those guys. How are the babies starting out?
Well, I worked through some growing pains with them. The first clutch I had, it was, I think I had like 15, and 100% hatch rate. They all came out perfect, and
awesome.
Just blew me away. I couldn't believe it. But, the babies were a little difficult for me to get started, to get acclimated to feeding them, and because, you have to basically do the whole feed and freeze technique, and I think it would take me probably 3 to 4 hours a night to get through, the clutch, because I would, you'd have to freeze and any movement, and they're going to unwrap, and then you're starting over again. And I figured out, by the second clutch, an easier way to do it. And basically, I start them off on rat pinks, and if you can get the head of the rat pink right into the snake's mouth when they strike, they usually just instinctively wrap, constrict, and the feeding process will follow. So if you don't do that, then chances are something isn't going to go right with it. But generally, that's what's worked for me, and just kind of step away quietly and, and generally they can go ahead and do it on their own. So I've cut down the time. They're a lot easier to get started than I initially thought.
Right.
And that was mainly my fault. But I haven't had one that has not started feeding. I mean, I've had everybody has come on to food on frozen thaw at one point or another. So
cool. Cool. So as far as, popularity for these guys, did you find it kind of hard to, do you still have a bunch? Did they not really go too far or anything like that? Or were they kind of quick to go once people realized that they were captive-bred goldface?
Yeah, I think that makes a big difference. You go to a show and it says captive-bred on there, and you're like, there's no way.
Really? Are you sure about that?
Well, where did it come from, and then you get, the guy that knows that information, he's not here right now, so you got to come back.
I'll wait for him. We'll get him. Yeah.
But it's a niche thing, it's white lips aren't for everybody, but I've been into them since I started. I mean, I just thought they were gorgeous animals. They're really interesting. They're so alert. They have great personalities, and they may draw blood, but kind of work with that. But they have done pretty well for me. I haven't really had any issues selling them. It's not something that is going to eat you out of house and home. So if you have to hold on to them for 6 months or so or whatever, it's okay. I mean, they're feeding on small meals. But I've had really good response to them, a lot of interest in because they are captive bred, really.
Cool.
So the demand is there.
I can't wait because my
I fell in love with the white lips before I even got into carpet pythons. I was over at my buddy Chris's, and he pulled a black phase out of a tub, and it chased him around the room. It was a big pissed off boy, and I'd always wanted them since then. So now that we actually got a collection, I'm stoked for babies.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Killer snake.
So, yeah. So that's all I got on the white lip front. Hopefully we get some things going on there. So
good luck with that.
Thank you. Eric,
we need
where are
more.
You?
We need more.
Yes, we do. Oh, my God. Look, well, I want the red face. Where the hell are they? Can I get them? So
the red face.
I got to find what island they're on, and then I'm just going to go get them.
Do you remember there was a green phase that Pro Exotics had back about maybe 15 years ago?
No. What?
It was a green, honest to God, it looked like a green rat snake. It was a green white lip, and I saw it in the Reptiles magazine, and they were working with it for a while, and I think it died before they could do anything with it. But really cool looking animal.
Crap. There's so many different, like, I want the T-Pos albinos. I want the freaking red phase. I just want to bring them over because it should be cool to have them one day.
Well, I'm, of course, being Morelia Python Radio, we couldn't have an episode without talking about carpets, Python. So what kind of carpet projects are you working with? Tell us a little bit about what you got going on there.
Yeah, I love carpets. I've always maintained carpets to some extent or another. The first thing I ever bred was 75% diamond jungles that I got from Python Pete. And just terrific, terrific animals. They've really done a lot, you know, for me as far as learning about carpets and just really cool animals keep in general, but you know, I'm still maintaining them. I really don't have anything crazy as far as, you know, different morphs of carpets or anything like that. I've chosen to work with what I got, and that's just a really nice line of jungle carpets, Aryngias, Jags, and Jags, Aryngias, Jungles, and the Diamond Jungles. So I think the Python Pete. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I just think the Python Pete line is really exceptional, mm-hmm. and it's unfortunate that he's not, you know, working with them anymore. But they're really popular. I've gotten great response from them, and they work great with other projects. So, but I love carpets. They're almost literally the perfect snake. You know, they don't get too big, they don't get too small. There's lots of different color variations. They're easy to keep, not difficult to breed. And be honest with you, of everything that I've ever had on my table at an expo, a really high quality, high contrast jungle carpet will still get the most response and the most people that stop and will comment about it, you know.
Right.
I don't know if you guys notice that, but it's just...
Yes, I do.
Oh, yeah,
it's
absolutely.
It's a classic look that is never going to go, you know, out of style. It's always going to be there. So, but I like working with the group I have. I kind of fell into a lot of the carpet stuff by accident. I got a trio of jungle carpets from John Battaglia and Morelli Trophy Club, and kind of got them in a trade, and not thinking a whole lot, just like, okay, you know, I'll bring these guys in, and they turned out to just be fantastic looking animals, and they've been really, really great to work with, produced a lot for me, adding them to my group, and the offspring have been just, you know, I've been holding back some of them and just trying to keep that quality, you know, in the line. So, but beyond that, I have some Caponetto line, Aryngias stuff, Jags that I'm working with.
Nice.
And I like them a lot. I don't have a lot of neuro issues with them. There's some, but you know, it's not really profound. It's not like there's, you know, half the clutch is like that. But you'll get a few.
Right.
But I like the color variations in them.
Yeah, I think that the first time you saw the Bullwinkle, that was kind of it for me. I don't know. I don't know about anybody else, but that was kind of it for me. But I was going to say a minute ago, the IJs you work with are the GQ line, correct? From
yes.
Anthony?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Right.
They're like the creme de la creme of the IJ world, so to speak. They're super nice.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah. Cool.
I just got my first Pure Aringia clutch last year, and it wasn't a huge clutch, but it was really neat. I mean, despite whatever the value, market value is, it was one of the, more satisfying clutches I had, because they're so neat as babies. I mean, they just come out, and they're just like this really bright orange and they're really cool animals, so I was really happy to produce them. And you know, his line is really superb, and look forward to keeping them and working with them.
Yeah, if you make some pure IJs again, we may have to talk. that's something I've been trying to track down forever. But okay, cool, cool carpet stuff that you got going on. Now another.
Yeah, the only thing, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
The only thing that I'm really looking to probably add to that would be the Carpondra or the Shea Veritas from Eugene. I mean, when I saw his, those things were just off the charts, amazing. I mean, just the color variations that he had from one to another were just, I couldn't believe it, you know. So that's the only thing I'd probably consider adding at this time.
Okay.
Really cool.
Yeah, they're definitely, I mean, say what you will about having hybrids or whatever, but they are some cool-looking snakes, you know. So they just had a video a couple days up, a couple days ago that I saw about showing some of those, and pretty not my cup of tea per se, but definitely some beautiful animals. I mean, they were just stunning. But another species that interests me that you work with, and you don't see many people working with them, is ring pythons. So we're sort of the champion for the underdog species of python, and I don't think there's probably any more underdog than the ring python. So I can't let this opportunity go past without talking about your experiences with working with them. You know, tell us about the species. Is there anything cool about them, or how you keeping them? How difficult are they to breed, and you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I would say they're underrated, but based on the demand for these things, I can't say they're underrated anymore. I mean, people just love them, you know, and it's interesting because they used to be, you know. In the early 90s, Mark Bell was putting them out in huge numbers. I don't know if huge is the right word, but he was putting a lot of them out, and you could find them for $125.
Right.
No problem. I mean, you could pick up a litter, whatever you want. I mean, they were just on the table, $100. No, you know. And it's funny, side note to that, Bob Clark, when he used to come down to the expos down here in Orlando and stuff, he actually had rings on his table, and I think he did produce them, but he was selling them for like $225, I think. And
Jesus.
I had the balls to go up to him, and I said, wait a minute, why are you selling for yours for $225? I could get them for $100 cheaper over here.
He
looked at me, and he's like, well, why don't you take yourself over there and buy his then? You know? And, you know. Just
right.
That's the appropriate response, I guess. But
yes, yeah, that's one I use.
Little did I know that they would be worth, you know, quadruple that. So, you know, I picked them up. I along with the white whips, there's something that I was interested in you know, early on, just I was kind of more attracted to the iridescent species. So something that I always wanted to work with. And, you know, when I got these things, I was never really interested in breeding them initially. I just wanted to keep them, you know. But, you know, the longer you keep animals like these, the more it evolves into, okay, well, maybe I can try to, you know, breed them. And once you understand the animal, I think that's, not to go off too far, but I think that's where a lot of, you know, beginners or, you know, people getting into it kind of, they miss that step as far as the actual husbandry and keeping them, and just get, kind of go straight into, okay, how fast can I breed this thing, you know?
Right.
It takes time, you know, you have to understand the animal and, they're really, really killer snakes. They, rings are, not, you don't see them a lot. Like I say, you used to see them a lot. They took a dip down in the 90s, and now they've made a comeback. Tom Keoghan has been a really terrific breeder, and he's supplied them for a number of years. He's had some really high contrast animals, and kind of led the resurgence, I would say. So I think we owe him a lot. But I've always maintained him. I've always kept him, and always knew that eventually I was going to get to that point where I'd try to breed them. And my group is, my colony has kind of evolved, and I've added some over the years, and it's just kind of worked out to where my adults are, have been productive for me, you know. I just had a clutch last night, actually, that was laid. And I think that'll be like the fifth or sixth clutch, probably the fifth. And since I've really started working with them. So they're not easy to work with as far as breeding goes. They're not a difficult species to keep, per se. They're pretty much like the white lips. They're a high humidity thing, and you want to have – they're a little more secretive than white lips. I mean, they like to hide. They like to burrow a little bit more. And the thing I get from most people is, well, if they stayed that bright orange and black, you know, I definitely get some. But, I mean, if you look at a really highly iridescent, beautiful adult ring out in the sun, I mean, there's no way you could dispute. It's just – the iridescence is just crazy. And
that's awesome.
They are
– I think it's probably one of those species that you'd have to see in person to really appreciate the full beauty of the snake.
Yeah, definitely. I think they're absolutely going to be more popular. I mean, I've never been able to keep them in stock. There's just the demand for them is there's just people love them. They want them. They try to buy up as many as they can. The prices I sold out last year at $8.50 a pair. And I think that was a bargain compared
right.
to, you know, what some other people were charging. So, but there's really no trick to breeding them. I keep them in a Neodesia 4-foot cage, and there's a section, a hole where they can go through. And I close it off when it's not breeding season. And when it is, I open it up, and I think that helps, you know, stimulate breeding activity with them. I think misting definitely helps. I think compatibility is a big issue with rings. There's some that, you know, it's just some males are not interested in this female, some are, you know, so you will get that. So I rotate my males with them and pretty much it for them. I mean,
okay. Do you think that that just like the jungle carpet, I think of the jungle carpet coming out of the jungle of Australia and what that looked like and now what it looks like after years of selective breeding. Do you think that the same could follow suit with these guys?
That's a good question, man. I think that if you got two super high contrast adults, then it would take generations.
Sure, absolutely.
I mean, I don't think it would be, I think it would be highly unlikely that you would get that super bright orange and black into adulthood.
Okay.
I think it's just a feature that is specific to them. But, you know, you never say never. There may be somebody working on it now, I'm sure. But I just, it's never been a focus of mine. I think if you can find any ring python, you're doing fine. And whether it's all, you know, whether it's all black or whether it's all orange or whether it's beautiful, you know,
roll
perfectly.
With it.
Yeah, you just roll with it. So they're just, my whole thing has been production. I just want to produce as many as I can because it just, it takes pressure off, you know, getting them from the wild. And I think it helps the hobby as a whole because it gets people interested in something besides ball pythons.
Yeah. Do you see, that you're saying that you see a resurgence, so to speak, in people interested in getting into, you know, rings and stuff like that. Do you see the hobby going back to the, what would it be, species-driven market instead of the morph-driven market?
Yeah, in my opinion, I think there's definitely a trend towards that. I think, you know, the ball python market is just saturated, and I think people are looking for something different. I think there's also a lot of ball python breeders that just want to have something different to work with. You know, just something to keep that interest peaked, you know. I think it's only going to get better. If the animals are there and if you can find them at a show, it's only going to help the whole thing. I mean, my whole thing from the beginning was I didn't want to have one uniform table of animals. I wanted to have diversity on my table so somebody could associate me with having different things to choose from, to look at, and I think it helps, you know, all around.
Sure. Absolutely.
But yeah, I think the niche market is, it's got to be, there's a demand for it, absolutely.
Yeah, and you know, like, especially with something like that, I mean, if you're the only guy that's producing ring pythons, and even if you only have one clutch or two clutches, and that's the only clutches available in the U.S., I mean, that's kind of like, you know, that's a good spot to be in.
But I will say, though, Eric, I will say that all these ring pythons that are being produced and sold over the last, I don't know, say 6-7 years, they're all getting up to maturity and breeding age. So I think that, in my opinion, I think there's going to be a lot of them that are going to be successful with them in the next couple of years.
Cool.
Now, it'll be interesting to see what the price does on them, but I think there's going to be more supply of ring pythons.
Cool.
Cool.
I always like seeing that underdog. Not, you know, when I say underdog, I mean, you know, the species that people kind of overlook because it's not as flashy, but, you know, they do interesting things or have different behaviors than some of your normal pythons or stuff, you know, or anything in general, you know. I think it's just, it's cool to have that something different, you know, in your collection to kind of, I think that's one of the ways to keep things exciting, you know. But another thing that I wanted to hit on with you is kind of your bread and butter, your passion, your claim to fame is retics. You know, I often see if retics could be the size of ball pythons or smaller, that I think that they would give the ball pythons a run for their money because some of the patterns and colors, and they just blow my mind on some of these retics. What's your thoughts on the retic market?
Yeah, no doubt. There are super, you know, super dwarfs, and, you know, I think they stay the size of a colubrid.
Whoa.
I mean, they're small.
Right.
Correct.
They're wow. really small. But they're, you know, highly priced, and there's not a lot of ton of morphs that have been worked into them yet. Now, I've chosen not to go in that direction. I just don't. They don't really do anything for me. You know, if I wanted something small like that, I would get a king snake, you know. And nothing against mm-hmm. king snakes, but if I'm going to keep retics, I want retics, you know. And,
right.
you know, so I think the market for retics would give I think it's close to giving balls a run for its money, you know. Will they ever have as many morphs? No, probably not. But I think the morphs that are coming out, you know, that are being produced every year are just, it's insane. I mean,
oh, yeah.
The stuff that, you know, these guys are putting out, you know, Nerd and NJ and Prehistoric, they're like 10 steps ahead of everybody. It's just, it's insane. So the combos that they're putting out, these triple, you know, triple gene snakes that are, the market is just, I think, probably one of the most exciting segments of the hobby right now. And the obviously you do have space consideration, you know, they're not for everybody. But I think that the thing that retics have going for them now is that a lot of the myths have been sort of dispelled. I think that through captive breeding programs, we can say that, you know, you don't have to have a psycho 20-foot female, okay, mm-hmm. to, number one, keep as a pet, or number two, breed. They don't have to be that big. Whether you choose to get them that big is up to you, but they don't need to have an 8-10-foot cage. You can keep a female in a 6-foot cage. The males don't necessarily need to be 3 years old. They can breed much younger than that. And I don't think it's necessarily pushing them. Like, I don't think you can really push a retic like you can a berm.
Right.
Because they're not as, you know, heavy body as a berm is, and they can't really, they're more slender, you know, but you can push them to an extent. But anyways, there's, I think there's a lot of things that they have going for them that we didn't know before, and the different mutations that are out, just, it's they're a really cool animal to work with. You do have to be careful, of course, but I love where the retic market's going. I mean, you look at just a standard purple albino, and it's still maintaining about, you know, $400 to $500. And that's really good compared to, you know, a lot of the different animals out there. So
sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna just say that my next question was along with that, do you think that because of the size that retics get, do you think that retic breeders have a bigger responsibility when selling their stock to people, to, you know, to make sure that the person that's getting that snake knows what they're getting into?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the regulations have been good. The legislation's been good in a way, for sure, because it's created more accountability for us as mm-hmm. keepers and breeders. You know, you have to be responsible, and you're not going to have as many incidents as, you know, you see if you have somebody that's, okay, going to be inspected by their local wildlife, you know, service or what have you, permitting agency. And I personally, you know, if I don't know you and I'm selling to you on the internet, I ask three things. I say, number one, you know, are you over 18? You know, number two, do you have big snake experience? And number three, know your local laws. And, you know, it's, I hate to have to go there, but it's necessary, because mm-hmm. if you don't, if you're a retic or whatever big snake, you know, supplier, and you don't ask those questions, then you're just opening yourself up to liability. So I think it's a responsible thing to do, and I'm not out to – I would rather lose a sale than just sell to somebody to make a sale, and they're going to be irresponsible about it, you know.
Right. Right. That makes sense.
Sure.
Too many
okay.
just walking around with baby retics, so.
Right. What type of projects are you working with?
I got some pretty cool stuff. I'm working with an ivory complex. So ultra ivories. I just got some new animals in this week. So hopefully ivory golden childs in the future. Amel golden childs, purple golden childs. I have the Rennick line ghosts. So get some ghost tigers, ghost super tigers. I think that's a really, really neat project that has a lot of potential. And ghost stripes, orange ghost stripes are super cool right now. Ghost stripe golden childs. A lot of purple stuff. Let's see what else. I have some little Slayer, dwarf, island dwarfs. Genetic stripes. So
cool.
Some high end stuff and some little stuff too. So if things fall right, you know, it should hopefully be a good year. But you know, with retics, you never know.
Okay. What is your most anticipated clutch with retics this upcoming year, 2014?
Wow. If I could get some ghost stripe golden childs, that would be really exciting. They are 2010s, so they should be, and the golden childs are more of a dwarf anyway, so they don't have to be necessarily huge. That would be nice. The ghosts, Rennick line ghosts are 2011, so they're, even though they're great feeders, and I have them on like 5-pound rabbits right now, I don't know if they're going to be quite old enough yet, but I would say right now the ghost stripes and the ivory stuff is really going to be great if I could get some production from them.
Cool.
Speaking
of breeding retics, how does that differ from breeding anything else? Are they the same? Is it more difficult? How does that, between, if you would range it from 1 to 10, what would be how retics rate for breeding, for level of difficulty?
Yeah, level of difficulty, I'd say probably around a 6, maybe. I think they're not as easy as people think. And I've actually seen on some forums where some retic keepers are like, they're not. Retics are easy, just put them together, you know. But I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, I think there's a lot of things that can go wrong. There's a lot of variability in them. And the people that have it down, you know, like the bigger breeders, they have it down. I mean, they know their animals inside and out. They've been doing it for a long time. But for me, there was a learning curve. I didn't just immediately get production. So it was. I had to kind of learn with the animals. You know, when I invested in retics, I had very little experience with them. I just knew that I loved them and I wanted to work with them. And I had to kind of learn with them. So the thing with retics is they can – I got bad advice from the start, and I'm not going to name names, but I was kind of led in the wrong direction, so it set me back a little ways, but retics can breed pretty much all year round, you know. So, you know, if you add a male, you know, every month to your female, for example, she might breed in an off month that you wouldn't think she would.
Right.
So that can be difficult when you're, you know, maybe a 1 or 2 person operation and you don't have a staff to constantly rotate males in. And when you have a female that's just, the feed response is incredible, you know, all year round. But it's, if you want to really produce, I think that's the way to go, is to constantly, you know, see when that female actually wants to go and ovulate. And but essentially, they're not that difficult. I mean, if the female is ready, then the male will follow. You know,
I don't do a ton of.
You know, I do a little bit of temperature drops during the season, but I don't do a ton of misting or anything like that. It's just if she's ready, you'll know, and if she's not, you'll know too. We'll start throwing each other around.
Right.
And one thing I would say is, though, for those that may be listening that don't have experience, watch your retics when you pair them up, because I had a female that just destroyed a male, and it was not a pretty sight. And it happened before I was still in the room, and then I just realized, you know, we realized too late that she really kind of mauled this male, and it was nothing we could do about it. But, you know, it's something that you don't want to just leave and not have them, not know what's going on with them. You want to at least see what the female's response is going to be, and kind of go with that. But anyway, so that's, you know, they're not incredibly difficult. I've done maternal incubation with one of my purple females a couple years ago, and that was primarily because I didn't get to the eggs in time. So at that point, she was highly defensive, and I wasn't about pulling at that point. So I just let her do it, and that was a pretty cool experience. And they actually turned out pretty good. I mean, I lost maybe a few more. Yeah, I lost maybe a few more than I would have if I put them in an incubator, but it was a great learning experience, and I would highly recommend it for anybody doing it to try it at least one time, because it's to see her behavior, and it's pretty neat. It's interesting. You can get a lot of good data too, as far as temperatures and you know what she's doing. So
that's awesome.
Cool.
That's really cool to hear. Did she shiver? Did you notice a lot of that and that type of thing? Okay. Cool.
Yeah, definitely. I kind of sealed the cage up so that I put a big tub of water in there. And the cage was actually the incubation chamber. So as long as it didn't get too hot and I kept the humidity, you know, around 80 to 90%, everything went really well. She did shiver. She did that constantly. And she was super defensive over eggs. I mean, if she left them to, say, get water, and you open the door and just slightly peeked in, she would be on you in like a second. I mean, no joke.
Really?
It was really, really impressive.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was cool. So towards the end of the process, the eggs started to get a lot of mold, and it got pretty funky in there. But
yeah.
But to see little purple heads coming out was really rewarding.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Cool.
Talk about go ahead, Owen. Go ahead.
Well, I'm saying, like, what I've seen and what I've been told from baby retics is when you incubate them, you pretty much got to cut that giant window in the top of the egg, or they tend to just frown. Is that true, or is that justifying cutting them out of the egg?
Yeah, I follow the same thing, whether it's retics or, you know, angolans or anything else. I mean, once the first pips out, then I start cutting. And
okay.
I'm not saying I don't use a razor blade like some people out there and just start, you know, kind of cutting open eggs like that.
Egg. Yeah.
Be nice about it. I mean, I just don't believe in that. I think there's still, you know, capillaries and there's still nutrition to be absorbed, and I just don't like doing that. I'll cut a small window and at least let them get out, because I've lost eggs in the past where they couldn't get out, you know, because the egg starts to harden and maybe the egg tooth doesn't function right, and you just don't want to take a chance. So as long as they're at term and you have them pipped, then I think you absolutely should cut them.
I agree. I usually cut a little bit of a slap. But, you know, I've still had babies go back in and drown. So, Sometimes they're just not meant for life. Anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
So, now if you're,
what were you saying?
I was just going to say, you're talking about eggs and such. What typically is the incubation time for retic eggs?
I found it to be right around 85 days.
85
wow.
days. Yeah, I thought it was a little longer. Very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could go a few days longer, but at 89 degrees plus or minus a half degree, it generally comes out to be about 85 days.
Okay.
Cool. So, well, all right, Chris, now we normally like to wrap up the interviews with some questions that kind of just might ruin your soul. And those are the fun questions. And the first question I put to you is, if you could have any species of python with no limitations on price, availability, legality, or anything like that, which one would it be?
One?
Just one.
You guys are killing me here.
Uh-huh. See, that's why they're horrible.
Man. Well, it would have to be Bolens. I mean,
Bolens.
So that would be the...
nice.
that would
wow.
be it for me.
That was a good one. Okay. All right. So if you could have any non-python species, what would it be?
That would be easy. That would be an eastern indigo.
Really?
An eastern indigo snake, because we can't keep them in Florida, for one thing.
Okay.
And
you always want what you can't have.
But they're really magnificent. I mean, I remember holding one as a kid, and I can't get that out of my head. It's just something that, you know, hopefully they don't become extinct at some point, but
right.
Yeah, I love to work with them and tried, but we got rules down here, so.
Right, I got you, and they take those rules serious. So, all right, cool.
Yeah.
First time a collier bridge has been brought up in that thing, but all right. Cool. So, what is your website, and how would people get in touch with you if they wanted to buy a fantastic retic or just pick your brain about something?
It's www.mysticreptiles.com. I'm on Facebook, Mystic Reptiles Facebook, which I'm just, you know, recently got into. I'm not of the tech you know, oriented. I'm more rustic in what I do and my approach, but, you know, I'm on Facebook now, and I, you know, update, and, you know, my email is chris@mysticreptiles.com, so I'm easily accessible, and, you know, I will spend time with anyone, questions or, you know, what have you. I think that's one of the things that's kind of been lacking in the hobby and the industry over the years, and I like to pride myself on providing one-on-one attention and helping whoever it is that needs it, whether you buy the animal from me or not. So I love talking snakes. So, yeah, I'm out there.
Awesome. Thanks. That's great. So I guess, Chris, thanks for coming on and talking snakes with us. And you're going to have to come back if you get some goldfish, or if I get some goldfish, so we can talk about baby white lips and some more and all that fun jazz.
Absolutely.
Awesome.
Fun.
So we're going to see you at ICAST, right?
Yeah, I'm going to be at the symposium next weekend. It's coming up soon.
Yeah.
Sweet.
So, yeah, it's going to be a great time. Looking forward to it. It's, you know, listening to Buddy, it sounds more like some kind of professional workshop or something, you know? With all the lessons on probing and, you know, ultrasound stuff. So it's going to be neat. Really looking forward to it. It's going to be a good time.
Yeah, I'm bringing those baby monitors, and they're my friend's baby monitors, and
I'm like, well, what about food for them? He's like, just buy some Pinkies at the show. I'm like, not that kind of a show, dude. There's not going to be Pinkies or anything like that. like, I really hate to break it, dude. You're going to have to send me with shit. So, yeah. So, something like that.
Yeah.
I had to get hammered into his head. So, it should be a great time, though. I can't wait.
Yeah. So.
Very cool. All right. Well, I guess we will see each other in about a week. And I look forward to meeting you and go over and check out Mystic Reptiles. Check out what Chris got going on. So,
cool.
Thanks for coming on.
Eric,
welcome back anytime.
Eric Owen,
yeah.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate the time and opportunity. And good luck, and we'll see you soon, man.
All right.
All right, man. We'll catch up.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
Good night.
Very, very cool show. Got to talk about some species that not a lot of people work with, and I always find
that. I miss my rings. I miss my rings so bad, and now talking to him is like, God damn it. So.
Yeah. Yeah, they're a cool species. I think that more people will be working with them. It's
pretty
cool.
He's exactly correct. They were miniature versions of the white lips. They were just crazy. They were just, that's the way they acted, the way they moved, the way they felt. They just were miniature versions of the white lips. So.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's kind of ironic that tonight we're talking to Chris about a guy that breeds retics, and I just got this action alert from US ARC. I'm just going to read this real quick and ask you to go over and sign this letter and send it over to your representatives. But basically they sent out a bulletin that says anti-pet groups are pushing to have the five remaining species of snakes, boa constrictors, reticulated pythons, three different types of anaconda.
The green anaconda, three different types of green, yeah.
Yeah, listed in the Injurious under the Lacey Act. In essence, banning all importation and interstate commerce. So the time to fight is now. There's a letter at the bottom of the page over on usarc.org. You can send it over and fill it out. It takes less than 5 minutes to complete the action alert below. Contact your representative and share it with as many people as possible. So we need to get the word out there to people.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that I talk about in my different messaging that I talk with people about snakes on a daily basis is the fact that sometimes it seems like our community is kind of divided more than it's together. I think about the carpet pythons in particular, just as an example. When people are fighting over whether a morph is cool or if it's not cool. I mean, you know, if we can't even agree that a snake looks cool or doesn't look cool, then we're pretty much screwed. So don't follow the mindset that just because Morelia isn't on this that, you know, we shouldn't care about it. We should care about
it
because...
It's a slippery slope. That's how it goes.
You know, boa constrictors, kind of in the same ballpark as carpet pythons. I mean, size-wise.
Pretty damn close.
Yeah. So. So, you know, it's kind of important that we band together. I think that, you know, as a community, you know, if you keep bearded dragons, you should care about this stuff as much as if you keep reticulated pythons. You know, I think that the opposition to us almost banks on the fact that we're not always 100% united. I mean, I just think that the time is now to unite and get together and fight for our rights, because your rights, what you keep is what you dig, and what I keep is what I dig, and I should fight for you as well as you should fight for me. And I think that the people that are fighting against us, they don't bank on that. And if we came from that approach, I think they might be surprised. Because you think about how many people keep reptiles in the United States, you know? But
a lot.
Yeah, it's just, you know, people.
Nobody wants to do anything further
if it's not their species, if it's not what a problem with them, why take the extra step? Or, oh, my stuff's not on here, but the problem is that it very well could be. I mean, think about New York. I can't bring my Isle of Pythons to New York. Why, like, and I know the scrubs can't go there either. And it's just because someone got a hold of a list, and on that list were a bunch of species, and they passed it through without really considering it, or anybody really making a big stink about it, because a lot of the very popular species were not on that list. So why limit the market? Why hinder us as keepers and breeders? And, you know, there's some people I know in New York who would love to have some olive pythons.
Right.
Scrubs, too. You just can't have it. But, so if there's ever anything in USR that need me to sign up for it, I don't care if it's we're trying to ban a turtle. Screw you. You can't stop it. You can't do that. So
yeah.
Sign everything you can if it's up there, because eventually it is going to be your species, and it is going to be the ones that you hold dear, and then it is going to be bad.
Yeah, because especially with some of these niche markets, ring pythons.
One thing,
I mean,
yeah,
is anybody really going to? Yeah, is anybody really going to care about ring pythons except the people that keep them? So I mean, you know, that's why we rely on the community as a whole to kind of fight for each other's rights. I mean, you know, maybe people don't give two craps about scrub pythons, but, you know, some people do, and some people want to work with them, and some people do a great job working with them. I will send this message out there as well. I mean, if you're one of those keepers that just kind of thinks you can sell these huge snakes without any responsibility to people, and you know, it's kind of good that
you're,
you know,
clearly an idiot.
Yeah, support so. People like Chris. I mean, because he's doing it right.
All
you know,
right.
If you're not of a certain age, or he doesn't think that you're of a certain caliber keeper, then he's not going to sell to you. And if he misses a sale, then so
that,
be it. You know,
that's how it should be. Because the problem is that, and you and I have seen it many, many times, where the guy comes over to, like, the table that you and I are sharing, and he goes, well, I've never really kept, you know, a snake as large as a carpet python. And then we try to tell him that you should do this and this, maybe not take carpet, maybe do, like, you know, something a little bit smaller, like, you know, ball python, whatever. And then later we see him leaving with a baby purple retic. And it's
yeah.
a problem. It is a huge problem. This is exactly how Burmese python became such a problem. They became popular, and no one checked up on who was buying them. Everybody got them, and there was a bunch of irresponsible pet owners out there. So once it all takes is one snake doing something that people don't like to get people all up in a tizzy. And it needs to stop. The only people who are going to stop it is us.
Yeah, I think it's our responsibility as breeders that we're being responsible with, you know, what we're doing with these animals. And we're putting them in the hands of people that are going to be successful with them. If I don't think that somebody's going to be successful with the species that I breed, I'm not selling to them. And I'm not going to jeopardize my rights or future rights or the animal simply because I'm trying to make some money about it. It goes deeper than
right.
that for me personally.
Right.
And I think that if more people had that approach, it would be a better community. So all I'm asking you guys to do is, whether it's the Herp Alliance or USARC, whatever because they both sent them out, whatever it is that you're a member of, just get the word out there to get over there and let's fight for our rights, because if we don't, they're going to take them away. So, you know, get involved. So I'll post the link over on the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page. I'm sure you're going to see it all over Facebook. But take the 5 minutes. Take the 5 minutes and do it. I mean, please. So that's really all I have that, you know, I just wanted to reemphasize ICAST,
mm-hmm.
the things that Buddy hit on. Pre-registration ends tomorrow at midnight for
midnight.
The T-shirt. And
the food,
if you're interested in that. Yeah, definitely.
Crab cakes and ribs. Who isn't interested in it?
Yeah. You're like an echo. Is there an echo in here?
Shut up.
What the heck?
Shut up.
Anyway, yeah, if, like Buddy said, if you're a procrastinator, you know, you're running out of time. So you definitely should head over there and register up. It's worth the shirt itself. I mean, so it's cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Don't forget, you know, all the different things that they're having, and it's pretty cool that he's talking about. If you're sort of sitting on the fence, I think the things that he announced tonight would be the thing that would push you over the edge. Our good buddy Ben with the ultrasound and the doctor, her name's slips me at the moment, but she's going to be doing
yeah.
probing and you know, injections, and these are all things that as keepers and breeders that you're going to run across, that you're going to need to know, and here's your opportunity to see it by experts in the field. So that alone is kind of worth the price of admission. So
yeah.
Go over and check out www.arboreal symposium.com and you know, register up. Let's see. What else do I have? Morelia Python forums. I have been going over there a lot lately, and it's glad to see that there are some people coming over and
mm-hmm.
Posting up, because say what you will about Facebook. I think it's a cool thing and everything, but it's instant gratification. I think that I'm going to use this thread that our buddy and your partner, Chris, posted up about breeding white-lipped pythons, experiences,
yes.
ideas, and theories. Definitely worth a read. I think it's already four, maybe five pages long. The thing I like about the forum set is that the fact that that thread will always be there. And then if you're
yes.
interested in writing or breeding white-lipped pythons, you're going to be able to go back and you're going to be able to reference that. You're going to be able to add to it if you'd like. Ask questions as it goes, but it's always going to be there. As opposed to Facebook, it's kind of there and then it's gone. It's difficult to retrace, to find back, to remember where a post was or whatever. I mean, again, it's two different things, but I think that it seems like the forum has kind of, you know, not gotten as much love as maybe it should have. I think that, you know, I'm seeing a new resurgence in over there. But Jason Hood, the guest we had on last week, all the cool
uh-huh.
colubrids that he had and that he was talking about,
yeah.
got posts over there about them. You know,
nice.
I'm looking at some of the new posts that are over there. Like I said, Chris's post about the white lips, Derek Roddy's tiger, black-headed pythons over there. Just some cool
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Go over there and check it out. www.moreliapythons.com. That's kind of where my stomping ground has been since 2007. It's a great place, it's a great community, and a lot of cool stuff going on over there. www.moreliapythonradio.com. Go over there, check that out, and that will link you basically to everything and anything that has to do with us. Our blog talk page, iTunes, Morelia Pick of the Week, Owen stuff, my stuff. Past guests, the forum,
right.
everything and anything that has ICAST is over there. Everything you need in the world of Morelia or pythons.
Right over there. Yeah.
Right over there at your fingertips. And I guess the
yeah.
last thing that I have is EB Morelia. Go over there, check it out, www.ebmorelia.com. I have a new thing going on where I have the Morelia files. And basically, maybe... once, twice, three times a week, I post up what it's like in the day of a Morelia Python breeder. Just my thoughts, insights. Maybe you don't, you're interested in something, observations.
Dear diary, today I walked down to the snake room. I'm sorry,
yeah.
stop that.
See, Owen, that's why me and you are different. You're a snake breeder. I have the passion
yeah,
for these things.
Oh, you knock it off.
Anyway, yeah, I just thought it's cool, a cool idea that maybe, you know, I think Ralph Davis did it with ball python, so it's not like it's a new idea, and
right.
a couple people do it, but I just thought it would be cool that maybe, you know, to post up my insights and thoughts and ideas and, you know, whatever. So go over there and check that out.
Cool.
And then check us out at ICAST. We're going to be there. We're going to be doing a show Saturday. Not exactly sure. I think I have it booked right now for 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock, somewhere in that time frame. I don't want Owen to be too tipsy, but I want to make sure that, you know, we get it in at a good time since we're going all the way until, what is it, 11 o'clock, midnight?
I suppose.
Whenever we feel like quitting. But anyway, yeah, we're going to be doing a broadcast there for the people that maybe can't make it out. Letting you know what's going on and giving you a play-by-play and letting you know what you're missing over there. That's all I got. Go ahead, Owen. Take us
cool.
out.
Cool. What I got is this weekend at Reading, we're going to have a reptile show up there. Rogue will be there, and I'll be bringing some Super Caramels with me. They're ready to go. So if you want to check out Super Caramels and can't make it to ICAST, I suggest you get your butts to Reading. Definitely come out. It's a cool show. Hang out. Talk snakes. Always enjoy talking with the with all you guys. So please come out. That's where I won't be bored. Anything else, you can go on to rogue-reptiles.com to get all the latest happenings of Rogue. The only animals for sale. You can also go to search Rogue on Facebook.com. If you become a fan of Rogue on Facebook, you will get the first look at any animals that go up for sale a week before they end up on Kingsnake or the public forums. So it is a little bit of help. If you are looking at something to get from us, you get first dibs before the general public. That's all I got. We hope to see you Saturday. And if we don't see you Saturday, we hope to see you at ICAST. That's all for us. So I'll say thanks for tuning in, and we will see you all next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.
Who are you to wave your finger? You must have been out your